This is The Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under the microscope. On this week's episode, Bill and Phil ponder Donald Trump selling Bibles, discuss the backlash against the liberal international order, and consider whether the U.S. should utilize illiberal actions to defend that liberal order. Now let's go to the lab.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Politics Lab. My name is Phil Barker, and I'm a professor of political science at Keene State College. And I'm joined by my colleague and best friend, Dr. Bill Muck, who's a professor of political science at North Central College. Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm doing well, Phil. We're recording in the morning. Normally, we record in the afternoon. So, you know, if we're not sharp this morning, it's just because we're doing too early. It's snowing here. Everything's out of, it's just all chaos.
It is. It's supposed to start snowing here. It's April, and we're supposed to get anywhere from 2 to like 18 inches of snow tomorrow. Jeez. I'm only on my second cup of coffee. Everything is off about the world right now, Bill.
We're gambling with this episode. It could be very good or it could be very, very bad, but we'll do the best we can.
Yes.
Oh, go ahead.
What were you going to say? We're already on like this. We're already off.
Yeah, we're just dropping airtime. We don't know how to interact with each other. We need to be at least on that third cup of coffee. Well, should we start by what happened to me yesterday, Phil?
Yeah. I want to hear more about this story.
So, and our listeners may find this interesting. So I have two kids who are now in high school, and so most of the time they take the car, which leaves me, the dad, with no car. So I find myself Ubering quite often back and forth, and it's just starting with that, Phil, Uber is amazing. It is just amazing that I can open my phone, push a button, and 4 minutes later somebody shows up and takes me wherever I want to go. It's unbelievable.
It turns out that doesn't happen in Keene, New Hampshire.
Globalization takes a while to seep into all the little crevices of the international system. So the other day I was called my Uber to get my ride home, and who shows up is this gentleman. I get in the car with him. We start driving. You know me, I like a little chit chat. So we're chatting about his car and whatnot. He's got a Tesla, and it leads to a conversation about technology and AI. And he starts talking about himself. And it turns out he is a Bulgarian rapper. And actually, he's a quite prominent Bulgarian rapper from the 1990s and early 2000s. So we start talking about this. And it's really, really interesting, his whole story. His rapper name is Big Sha. So if you're so inclined, you can go up and look at him. He's got a Wikipedia page. He's also very political, which sort of made this conversation really, really interesting. So we started talking about all of that and his political views. In the 90s and early 2000s, he was very open about his socialist leanings. But what was really, really interesting about all of this is we started talking about, you know, politics in the United States and Trump and all of that. And he mentioned that, you know, growing up and living in Eastern Europe, and I quote, he says, "I can smell a dictator. I can smell an authoritarian." And he said, "Trump smells like an authoritarian," which was sort of really fascinating to have this conversation about, you know, somebody who grew up in an oppressive system, lived under the Soviet Union, you know, and then also had this sort of reflection. I got the sense that he had to flee Bulgaria because of his political views. So it was great. I mean, he starts telling me that he has recorded a video with Snoop Dogg. So Phil, all of this happens on my ride in Naperville, Illinois, a Bulgarian rapper. We're talking about AI and democracy and globalization and authoritarianism just on my little Uber ride home. It was extraordinary.
That's pretty fantastic. If I remember correctly, I have, like, as you were talking, I remember I had this like image pop into my head of Tom Friedman, who is a New York Times writer who has written all sorts of books. I feel like he has lots of conversations with cabbies about the world of it. Yes. You're basically Tom Friedman. So this is pretty fantastic.
It is. If Tom Friedman just hangs out in Naperville, Illinois, right?
No, I mean, this is really, it's a fascinating story. There's so many elements to it. Well, part of it is just the sort of globalization and the immigrant story and all of that comes with it. But yeah, I mean, I think the part that you mentioned there at the end is I think about, like, from comparative politics perspectives, right? Like, that we in the United States have it's both a blessing and a curse, right? It's a blessing that we haven't had to deal with this sort of authoritarian type of, I mean, I say that, that's in recent years, right? Like, there's, like, you know, there's millions of you know, Black Americans who are like,
sure. yes, absolutely.
But the idea again of living under that sort of authoritarian system, and again, from a comparative political scientists say this over and over and over again, when you look at the United States, right? If it were any other country, alarm bells would be going off, and it doesn't surprise me at all that someone who lived under that sort of system would see the warning signs here in the United States. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
It is. And also the sort of the interconnection of all of this, right? You know, I think about 25 years ago, the chance of me, you know, of course, there was no Uber. Like when we went to grad school, there were no Ubers, right? And now there are Ubers, and then I can have a conversation with a Bulgarian rapper that, you know, touches on artificial intelligence and politics and you know, U.S. Authoritarianism and all of this. And it sort of speaks to the moment that we live in, that these conversations are global. They're not simply local conversations anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, when you were in grad school, you rode the bus, and you specifically try to avoid talking to people when you're on the bus, right?
I had a routine because I would you know, you're always like, you'd like to have that seat next to you. And one of the things I figured out is if you read a paper, and in those days we read physical papers, if I had my paper open and they can't see your face, they're less likely to sit with you. I studied this. The other problem is, though, that when I see somebody, I always smile. And if you smile, it dramatically increases the chance they sat with you. So if I had my paper up, I had the open seat when I, you know, yeah. Absolutely. This is what political scientists do, Phil. We study things. So
you're like me, though, because I'm the type, too. I think it annoys people I travel with. But I like having those conversations with people. I mean, I typically think of it as when we travel. You and I have traveled together and we've had these sorts of experiences. But even when I'm, you know, traveling alone, those chances to chat with other people about not only about their politics, but about how they view the United States and how they view America is really fascinating. It's the beauty of travel. I think about when you and I went to Chile, right, which has this similar history of a different type of authoritarianism. But you could feel that sort of legacy there still. And you could, you know, in conversations with people. It's really, you know, illuminating. And we live in a world today where you don't have to travel around the world to have those interactions. That's the really cool part of it. I mean, Kelly and I were just in New York last week in New York City, and it's the same thing where everywhere you go, you're interacting with, you know, people from all over the world, and you get those different perspectives. And I mean, it's I don't know. How does he feel about going from being a sort of a prominent rapper to a Uber driver?
He seemed, you know, we didn't cover that, but he did seem to love the idea of being an Uber driver. And the other thing he talked about is that, because that's how we got into AI, he said, you know, eventually that, you know, the cars will drive themselves and he'll be out of a job. But he said he wasn't worried about that. He's like, every moment in history, we've had some new technology that replaced old jobs. He's like, we always find new jobs. There's always going to be jobs. So he was a very optimistic rapper about the future of artificial intelligence as well. So I will say one complicating part of it is if you go to his Wikipedia page, they talk about him as being one of the top rap artists of the 90s and early 2000s, but that his career began to wane when his partner was sentenced in 2003 to 12 years in prison for running an organization that exported Bulgarian prostitutes, right? So, I mean, so there's, again, there's a lot of complexity to this as well, where you're like, you know, that's not a good thing. but, you know, this is globalization as well, where you get to meet somebody who's had a variety of connections.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah. So, all right. So that's my Bulgarian rapper in the Uber story.
Wait, so before, I have one more question, which is when does you and he are doing a collaboration, right? Like this is going to drop soon.
Well, as weird. So if you go, you can find the video of him and Snoop Dogg rapping together. That's weird. But it would be even weirder if I was rapping with a Bulgarian rapper. That would be just not. It wouldn't be okay.
You're now like 2 degrees of separation from Snoop Dogg, though, and that's like this is. I always felt like you and Snoop had a lot in common. So
this is the smartest thing you've said in a long time. So, all right, we got to talk about Trump and Bibles. But before we do so, tell everybody how they can stay connected with us.
Yeah. So thepoliticslab.com is our webpage. You can go there and find all the information about Bill and I and about the podcast, but you can also find all of our episodes. And on every episode page, there are links to articles relevant to the topics we talk about that week. And so we're going to talk about a number of really interesting articles this week. You can find all of them on thepoliticslab.com. Go there, click on this week's episode, and the links are there. Easy to access, easy for you to do a little more deeper reading if you feel like it.
That's fantastic. All right, Phil, Trump is selling Bibles?
Yeah. So I know this will shock you, Bill, but Donald Trump is selling something. On the heels of his forays into digital trading cards and gold sneakers and, you know, what else? What else? He sold steaks. He sold, like, you know, what all these
universities.
Things. University yep. diplomas. That's right. So Trump has now announced that he is selling Bibles, but not just any Bible. The God Bless the USA Bible that includes copies of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Pledge of Allegiance, and the other, you know, key founding document, a handwritten copy of Bill's favorite song, God Bless the USA by Lee Greenwood. You get all of that for the low, low price of only $59.99.
It's a steal.
I'm going to play a clip from Trump's intro of, or his part of a clip of his sort of sales pitch. It's a little bit of a long clip, but there's so much like insanity in this. I felt like I had to go with a little bit of a longer clip. So let me play
this here. You have to. Absolutely. Listeners should tune in. This is the most important thing you'll hear all episode.
Here we go.
I'm proud to be partnering with my very good friend, Lee Greenwood. Who doesn't love his song, God Bless the USA, in connection with promoting the God Bless the USA Bible. This Bible is the King James Version and also includes our Founding Father documents. Yes, the Constitution, which I'm fighting for every single day, very hard, to keep Americans protected. Also, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Pledge of Allegiance are all part of this God Bless the USA Bible. And it's just very important and very important to me. I want to have a lot of people have it. You have to have it for your heart, for your soul. Many of you have never read them and don't know the liberties and rights you have as Americans and how you are being threatened to lose those rights. It's happening all the time. It's a very sad thing that's going on in our country, but we're going to get it turned around. Religion and Christianity are the biggest things missing from this country, and I truly believe that we need to bring them back, and we have to bring them back fast. I think it's one of the biggest problems we have. That's why our country is going haywire. We've lost religion in our country. All Americans need a Bible in their home, and I have many. It's my favorite book. It's a lot of people's favorite book. This Bible is a reminder that the biggest thing we have to bring back America. And to
all right. So it keeps going from there. But this it's just a taste. It's just a taste of the of a little bit of the insanity of wow. that. Of that intro. So, you know, Bill, a lot has been written this week pointing to the irony of Donald Trump selling a Bible, lots of people sort of making fun of this situation. But there's also some real political issues tied up in this, including the fact that Donald Trump is badly in need of money due to his legal bills, the problematic nature of a presidential candidate endorsing products for his personal gain, and the many sort of strange ways in which Christians in America have been co-opted by Trump and his policies. We can get into sort of church and state stuff. There's just a lot here. So, Bill, you want to start with the serious topics or do you want to make fun of Donald Trump in the situation a little bit?
We have to start with some fun. I got to get it out of my system. Then we can grapple with the real issues. Like, how weird does this feel, right? This is, I mean, it's strange to have a presidential candidate be selling stuff, right? That's just weird. But to be a Bible, like the language, you know, there's a lot of, people always talk about that when Trump is saying, he's like projecting, when he's criticizing or saying, and, you know, he talks about it's my favorite book and that I have many, which means he has none. He has no Bibles in his house. Right. And, you know, he notes that many people have not read these books or the book and the Constitution, which also is him suggesting, oh, by the way, I haven't read this book or the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. It is, I mean, it's just, oh, it is so weird and goofy. I'm guessing, now, I don't know, did you saw this as a good form of capitalism, or what was your reaction to
I saw this as a good form of Christianity, right? This is spreading the word. No.
Yes.
No. Oh. Yeah. I mean, it is. And yeah, I went to, in preparation for this, I went to the God Bless the USA Bible webpage, and you can look at it. And it's like, you know, Lee Greenwood with his picture with all of, and every picture is what you would imagine of like the people who would be selling of, you know, buying these. But yes, I mean, I grew up in a conservative, I grew up in a Christian like household, but it like the number of ways that this is problematic, right? Like the commodification, the sort of capitalism of selling this Bible and making it it's just so awful. But I mean, it's also the transparency, like you said, the fact that like so many people can be fired up about this, which I that's where I come back around to that you were saying, like, there's no chance that he has actually read this or done these sorts of things. I feel like the people who are buying it are the same, right? They're not like actively reading their Bibles. This is a showpiece that's a statement of loyalty or whatever. But yeah, it's kind of insane.
If we get to dive a little bit deeper into this, I think the fact that you're putting it into one book is really revealing for me. So, you know, we all grew up taking these civics classes where the idea of the separation of church and state was central, right? Everybody sort of learns that. The beauty of the American political system is a separation of church and state, and that you're entitled to your religion, but we keep religion out of politics. And, you know, sort of a very novel way of thinking about political systems. But what he's doing here is he's intentionally combining them in this one book where you've got the Bible and the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the Pledge of Allegiance, like all of them in one. And so it's sort of this great metaphor of the desire to no longer keep those separated, right? That we are truly a Christian country, and that how we should be governed is through the lens of Christianity, right? I mean, there's a very theocratic element to all of this. It's like, you know, let's move past church and say that for me is really sort of stunning as well.
Well, so my research has been on it's been in Europe, but it's on religious nationalism. And one of the, like, I make the argument in my in the stuff that I've done that the part of how you measure that, like, I look at two things, one of which is identity. Like, how do people identify? Like, to what extent does being Polish, you know, equal being Catholic? And then the other is, like, to what extent do religious views sort of permeate, like, legislation? So it's identity, but it's also the politics part of it. And this encapsulates both, right? I mean, the idea that we're going to put together the Declaration of Independence and the Pledge of Allegiance with the Bible sort of is implying both things, that being an American and being, you know, and having a Bible are one and the same, and that, like, the stuff in this book is what should be, you know, central to how we govern the country. So it is really this kind of weird merging of both of those. And we talk about Christian nationalism and whatnot, and there's this active debate about, you know, is the United States like a, you know, in terms of religious nationalism, is American nationalism, you know, Christian nationalism? And the U.S. is a weird case. It's not as clear as a place like Poland or whatever, but I think what has become clear is that one party, at least, it is very clear that link is there, that being a good American equals being a Christian, and that the, you know, legislation should be dictated by the teachings of the Bible. That's just become such a, I don't think that was even always the case about the Republican Party, right? You had the, you know, so many, like, kind of classic Republicans that were, you know, small government or pro-business, but under Donald Trump, it's like they're one and the same.
That's such an important point, right? It gets to these deeper questions of what does it mean to be an American? Who is an American? And when you see this, right, Donald Trump is being very clear about who is a good American, who, like, what is America? America is Christianity. And sort of it creates this us versus them dynamic. And we've talked about that at length, but it's not just that you're conservative. It's not just that you're religious. You're Christian, and that's what it means to be an American. And others are welcome here, but that's, you know, the core of who we are, and our political system should reflect those views. I mean, it always strikes me, it's obviously there's a huge difference between the United States and Iran, but that sort of philosophy that we're seeing, this idea that faith should inform politics, that's what we are so critical of Iran and others for being a theocracy. But there are now voices that are saying, no, that's where the United States needs to move, right? Yeah. You know, it's basically a form of Sharia law, but you can never call it that because, you know, the conservatives hate the idea of Sharia law, but they're really proposing a Christian alternative to that.
Well, I mean, this goes back to, a couple of months ago when we were talking about the Alabama Supreme Court decision, right? Yes. When the guy who quotes the Bible in his judicial decisions, right? And he's very open about it. And so, the other part of this that I think is really interesting is that the U.S., because we, I don't know, like because of the last really kind of 75 years of American history, but really, you know, really significantly the last sort of 40 to 50 years of American history, politicians have sort of paid lip service to religion in ways, going back to Reagan and others, that has left certain, I don't know, there's like a blurring of that line. That means that I think Donald Trump, like, is this plays really well for Donald Trump. This is an example of where he has different audiences that perceive it differently. And I think people who want to like him are able to look at him and say, yeah, this is just what politicians do. He's not being serious. You know, this is, again, whether it's Reagan or whoever, this is, you know, Eisenhower. We've had these sorts of in the past, these this kind of you pay lip service to. And even if you were like a non-Christian, you could look at Donald Trump and sort of chalk it up to that's kind of how American politicians do this. But it also, the for the audience that believes this stuff, it is like it is. It's a message that plays. We talk about this with Donald Trump in other ways where he talks about race or whatever. And what people hear varies, I think, depending on what they're looking for. And I think there's a lot of people who see this not as, you know, a political stunt, but as this is, you know, affirmation that he is the person who's going to usher in this religious, era of American politics.
And I think that that's also a really, really important point, right? So one is the sort of blending of church and state, but also the unique role that Trump is playing as both a political and religious figure. And he encourages that. So, you know, we just had Easter this last weekend, and Trump was, I would say, tweeting. He's with Truth Socialing a lot. And one of the things he shared was somebody drawing a comparison between Trump's legal suffering and Jesus and Easter, right? And that sort of making a parallel between those two individuals. And Trump shared that message, right? Suggesting that he at least partially endorses the idea of thinking of him as going through a similar dynamic to what Jesus went through, right? And again, they're very clear to say that he is not a religious figure, but you see lots and t-shirts and hats that say, you know, Jesus is my God and Trump is my president, or versions of that, right? And that sort of connection of Trump as being almost a religious prophet-like figure is also out there. And that's a really curious and I would say... Yes. It's a troubling development.
Bizarre. Yes, it is strange to look at Donald Trump and see, suffering or like, to make that. But it also says a lot about Donald Trump. Like if someone came to you and tried to compare you to Jesus, you would immediately be like uncomfortable and be like, that is bizarre. Yes. And, but Donald Trump is like happy to embrace it, right? Like it tells you something about who he is and how he sees himself as well, which should be the immediate warning sign for people who are looking for, you know, a religious type of leader. But it is this weird, we talked again, over the last month, we've talked about how this weird kind of merging or this move of the religious, community or the evangelical community in particular into politics has kind of so corrupted. I saw one of the articles that was talking about this cited, even like how quickly this has happened, that this is not, I mean, this is a thing that has been happening over the past 40 years, but this like co-optation of the religious movement by Trump has been really remarkable. Like they cited poll numbers that went back to, I think prior to the 2016 election, the number of Christians or of evangelical Christians, I don't remember if it was all Christians or evangelical Christians, that said that character was like, you know, an important trait in choosing a president. Or it was worded the opposite. It was that sort of moral character would eliminate a candidate. It was like, you know, it was like 30% of evangelical Christians said that they would still support someone who had, moral problems, moral flaws. And now it's like 75%. So this is in a period of like 8 years, right? Yeah. Like that's half of evangelical Christians who have gone from saying that character is important enough that I would not vote for someone who had character questions to now people who are basically saying it's not an issue. Like I'm going to support Donald Trump regardless of the character.
That's really interesting, especially when you think about going back to the 90s with Bill Clinton and some, you know, the moral majority. The critique of Clinton on the right was that he was, you know, he had behaved in immoral ways, that he was, you know, he had been unfaithful to his wife, and that matters, right? Character matters. And we've seen a very, very different shift in the Republican Party where now it's okay to be flawed, right? And that you can be flawed and still be God's vessel for, you know, democracy. It's really something. David French, we've talked about him in the past. He writes for the New York Times. He's a conservative, very religious man. He had a piece out this week basically critiquing this shift to thinking about Trump as a prophet. And he talked about that on the right, not in the mainstream news, you're seeing this happen quite regularly, right? And he said, this conversation is happening, but we're not really talking about, you know, Trump as this religious type figure. And you know, he was sort of troubled by that development. And it reinforces the...
Right.
And it reinforces the sense to which the Republican Party has become the party of Trump as an individual, right? Yep. It's not about Republican orthodoxy anymore. When it becomes a cult, it becomes... Max Weber used to talk about this, right? Well, I'm trying to think about his phrase. He described like the personality of things and, you know, the idea that somebody can become bigger than the party or the political system. Yeah. And I think that's what we're seeing with Trump right now, that he is this individual and there's a comfort level connecting him to religion. We haven't even talked about an issue that you've hit on over and over again, which is the money side of this, right? So maybe you want to talk a little bit about why the fact that Donald Trump is selling Biden and the financial troubles, like why that should matter.
Well, first of all, before I do that, to go back to the Max Weber thing, it's a really interesting point. This is a political science nerdy thing. But so, you know, Max Weber is, you know, famous sociologist, political, you know, scientist. But he wrote about like legitimacy, right? And this is I think about he talks about like democracy is essentially based on. So when we talk about legitimacy, a government is legitimate when people view it as having a right to govern, like they see it as a legitimate. So we talk about, you know, even, you know, you go back to Bush Gore, you know, even people who voted for Gore were willing to go or see, you know, saw Bush as legitimate because he won an election, went through the Supreme Court. Those were legitimate. So he didn't win the popular vote, but it went. The institutions, the rules of the game are what give legitimacy to the leader. But there's another form of legitimacy, which is charismatic, which is the person, the idea.
You're so smart. Yeah. You remembered it. Yes.
Yeah. So charismatic legitimacy is this idea of the person or their ideas. And it's really a fantastic point, Bill, because it's what Donald Trump is doing is shifting. He's busy attacking the institution. So he's undermining the institutions, which means that the only way to have legitimacy is through the personality, right? It's Donald Trump that is legitimate, not elections that make him illegitimate. And that is, you know, that... Oh, it works for a time being, but charismatic legitimacy is inherently more fragile than institutions, right? Because when Donald Trump goes away or dies or whatever, the whole system is undermined. So, it's problematic for all sorts of reasons, but it really does fit into it.
Look at you. I bring up Max Weber and you're instantly able to give a 2-minute synopsis of his idea of a charismatic leadership. That's impressive.
Well, you know, I read Max Weber every night when I go to bed, Bill. So
this is good.
No, the money thing is really interesting. I because it's, you know, the Donald Trump is, you know, despite all his claims about money and whatever in the past, he's had lots of money. But because of all his legal bills, he's strapped for cash. All the indications are that, you know, Joe Biden has more money on hand. He just did a huge fundraiser with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton in New York that brought in like $30 million more dollars. He's, you know, Joe Biden has money on his side right now. And Donald Trump not only is lacking in money, but his legal bills continue to pile up. And so it should be there's something about this that's very kind of classic, you know, snake oil salesman huckster kind of stuff, like hawking Bibles on the side. But the fact that he's like needing to do that you've seen this series of gold sneakers and Bibles and whatever is like a testament to the, I think it is a statement about his desperation for money. Like he needs money right now. And it's unfortunate that he's able to, you know, essentially take advantage of so many people to do this. But yeah, it does say something bigger about where he is. And I think the potential problematic. And again, if you're a Republican, this another reason you should be worried about him, because all of his resources and energy are going into making himself money so that he can pay his legal bills. It's not going into, you know, furthering. It's going into furthering him, not going into furthering the party, right? And this is actually a real advantage for the Democrats if they could sort of, you know, double down, not just on Joe Biden, but on state level races and all this other stuff. Donald Trump is taking all the energy and resources of the Republican Party for himself, which leaves this huge opportunity for Democrats if they are smart enough to take advantage.
That's a great point. I often think about the space it creates for foreign actors to try to intervene to influence, you know, Trump. I mean, there was somebody, you know, recently there have been a lot of intelligence officials or former intelligence officials talking about whether Trump, whether they would grant Trump a security clearance. And right. most of them say, absolutely not, right? If he, other than being president, there's no way he would ever get anywhere near even a most basic security clearance because he's so compromised, right? And so this could be, I mean, this is actually a real challenge or a question for Joe Biden because traditionally the president grants the other major candidate in a presidential campaign access to intelligence. So if you're Joe Biden, do you say, okay, Donald Trump, here, you have access to all of this intelligence so that when if you were to win the election, you would be up about what's going on? And I think there are a lot of people, and I think myself included, who might say, no way. No. You know, if you're selling Bibles and sneakers and hundreds of millions of dollars in debt, the country can't take that chance. It's a really messy proposition to link an election to this sort of debt and again, blatant selling of Bibles for a little bit of cash.
Yeah.
Oh, this there's a lot there, Phil.
Yes, there is.
Well, should we transition?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so we've got to transition away from Trump and his Bible sales to look at the state of the international system. And specifically, we're going to think through some of the ideas in a new book by Fareed Zakaria titled Age of Revolutions, Progress and Backlash from 1600 to the Present. We've included an excerpt from the book on our webpage. The book explores the backlash against the world that emerged following the end of the Cold War. That was a world of liberalized markets, the democratization of politics, and the explosion of information technology. Yet these changes have also unleashed a wave of illiberal populism that is skeptical of openness, globalization, trade, immigration, and diversity. We've talked a lot about that on the podcast. Now, what caught our attention this week was his discussion of the role of freedom in this backlash. Zakaria notes that improvements brought about by these changes, quote, often upend traditional ways of living, leaving many people feeling unmoored. Unmoored is such a great word, Phil. he writes that, quote, we also know that when human beings embrace freedom, they can end up feeling profoundly ill at ease. Freedom and autonomy often come at the expense of authority and tradition. As the binding forces of religion and custom fade, the individual gains, but communities often lose. The result is that we might be richer and freer, but also lonelier, unquote. Phil, that's really, really interesting stuff. All right, Zakaria also references the political scientist Francis Fukuyama and his famous book, The End of History. So if students have taken a class from Phil and I, we've probably talked about that in one of your classes. Zakaria writes about Fukuyama's worry that the West's victory over communism would leave Western societies rich and tranquil, but would also make everyone passive. People would be left with no great ideological cause to defend. People would spend their days pursuing their material needs and wants and feeling empty, alone, and depressed. Zakaria argues that this helps us understand the rise of Trump and populism. He argues that for many, populism, nationalism, and authoritarianism fill the hole created by freedoms of modern society. Holy crap, Phil, that's fascinating and explains so much of our politics today. So let's dive in. What do you make of all this?
I think this is brilliant. I think it's really fascinating. And I think there's a lot of truth to this. Starting at a surface level, like, you know, beginning with this idea that, you know, starting with Fukuyama's ideas that the victory would leave people, you know, Western societies rich and tranquil. The immediate thing I thought of as you were reading that is Tom Nichols, who talks a lot. I mean, people might be familiar with him. He writes for The Atlantic, but he does lots of stuff, or he used to do lots of stuff on Twitter and whatnot. But I'm really interesting guy, but he's, you know, conservative, who's been critical of Trump from the beginning, but he talks a lot about that, about how, like, we are at a place in America where we are essentially spoiled, right? Like that we sort of miss the stakes of, and he's a Soviet scholar, so Soviet Russia scholar, so, you know, sort of missing this actual contrast. Like we don't actually recognize how good we have it. And so he talks a lot about, you know, people who aren't willing to turn up and vote, or people who don't see Trump as a real threat or whatever. And I think there is sort of a loss of that perspective that comes from this. The other part of it, and the sort of deeper part, I find really fascinating, because again, we just talked a little bit about this, but, you know, looking at, as somebody who studies religious nationalism, there's been a lot of talk about similar trends with religion, because religion, you know, it's a similar thing. As the world has sort of become more secular, one of the things that that does is it kind of uproots you from your identity, from your traditional values and whatnot. And that secularism, you know, there's positive elements to that, but it leaves people feeling sort of lost. And one of the ways that you kind of reground yourself is by refinding religion. And so there's this kind of cycle of secularism, but then this sort of return, this need for identity and understanding. And it's a similar thing going on with politics. And that takes me to this other, I'm probably going too deep here.
Oh, I got three good ideas that you've already mentioned. Okay, so this is great.
Good. The other thing is there's writing in like talking about religious nationalism that talks about how, you know, religion and nationalism both are, I think this is Mark Juergensmeyer. I don't remember exactly. Maybe that's not true. I'd have to go back and look. But anyway, basically argues they're both ideologies of order, right? What that means is they both kind of help us structure they help us make sense of the world around us. They tell us who we are. They give us meaning. They tell us what values that we should, you know, focus on. They tell us, they give us sort of a moral code. So let me kind of do an example. Religion does that, right? We have our saints. It tells us right and wrong. It tells us who we are. It tells us there's something bigger than us. Nationalism does the same thing, right? So if you think about, like, what does it mean to be an American? We have our sort of saints, right? Our founding fathers and whatever. It tells us who we are, what matters, what are our important values, like American values matter. It tells us there's something bigger than ourselves, like, you know, America and whatever whether that's liberalism or whatever you want to do. But so they play a similar role. And so a lot of times they sort of conflict, and you can see this sort of in the French Revolution, right? Where there's this battle between religion and nationalism. But other times, because they play a similar role, they sort of merge. And so I see that as we look at like religious nationalism in the United States, Christian nationalism, a lot of it comes from this. Like it is a result of the victories of the last, you know, century. It is, you know, that we are a freer society that sort of, you know, and freer meaning politically freer, but in terms of religion, your ability to sort of pick and choose what you want, religion has become sort of less, but all that leaves us feeling like at a loss of those bigger questions about why are we here? What's the purpose of this? And so, I mean, there's so much writing about how war and conflict and whatever also answers those questions. And I think there's something really concerning about that the freedom that we now exhibit is comforting and also disconcerting at the same time. I don't know. So that was a very academic. You take that and make sense of it for our reader, for our listeners, readers.
Well, let's talk a bit about, like, because I think you hit on a really number of really interesting things. The appeal of ideology and authoritarianism, right? Because that's really what you're getting at. And after the Cold War, there wasn't a great fight anymore, right? So the Cold War gave us this simple conception of good versus evil, like religion does, right? It says, let me simplify the world for you. So communism and the Soviet Union were bad, and the United States was good. And when that goes away, we don't know who's good or who's bad. And so this leaves this emptiness. And so, you know, other things are starting to fill that hole. And what we're seeing is, especially for Christian nationalism, populist, like that's what's filling the hole. As you were talking, it made me think of George Orwell, I mean, a long, long time ago, wrote about the appeal of Hitler. And he said, you know, we should understand why Hitler had appeal. And he gave you a cause. He gave you something to fight for, right? Mm-hmm. He wasn't saying, let's just make more money. Let's go out and change the world. No, it was a pretty dangerous and hateful ideology, but he gave you something to believe. And I think as humans, we want something to believe. We want to, or at least a large chunk of us, you know, some cause to fight. And what we've seen in the aftermath of the Cold War is we fought the war on terror, right? Okay, we got a new bad guy, right? It's terrorism and Muslims, right? So this sort of ugliness of race and identity in that framework. But then when that went away, we've turned on ourselves. So the new enemy is us, you know, right? And so that's where the populists and the Trumps of the world, the demagogues say that the enemy is within. That's sort of interesting to think about all of that and that dynamic playing out. And, you know, how do we fill this identity gap? And we should say it's not everybody, right? There are a lot of people who love this freedom, right? You think about marginalized, historically marginalized groups who now have the space to say, you know, I want to pursue my white rights. You know, if I'm a woman, I think we should do more about women's rights, and we should do more about LGBTQ rights, and we should think more meaningfully about race, that now we have the space to have those conversations. But when you have those conversations, it only further alienates those who are not in those marginalized groups, who are still looking for somebody to fight. And boy, they sure can be a great other as well, right? I mean, so you're hitting on all these really, really important ideas here.
Yeah, I think to sort of build off of some of that, I think about, you know, the appeal of Hitler or whatever. And I think about, like, the, you know, you can make these connections to, I think of Charlottesville, right? Like, how do people get caught up in this kind of, you know, far right sort of, you know, anti-diversity, anti-minority movements? And I think it's that same thing. It is a sense of, like, what those, when you look at those, you know, the people involved in those marches, there's something there in that it's sort of fraternity like, right? There's like this belonging, a group of other people like you. You have something to, you know, it's empowering, right? I think that's a big part of it. It feels like you're in a world in which you don't feel all that powerful. It is empowering to be a part of a group like that. And I made that connection to Hitler, but it's not all that different from other patriotic movements, right? Like, whether it's in the United States in the build up to World War II, it is this, we're a part of a thing, right? We're all together. It is, I'm not alone in this. And so that sort of group mentality is there's appeal to it. And I think there's, you know, building off of that, we've talked also about, like, authoritarian personality types in American politics. And I think about, like, there's this blooming of people who like order and structure, right? And there's been this, I don't know, convergence between
change.
That. Yes, and the Republican Party in recent years. But I, you know, again, it's living in the world we live in, you know, as you have, this is, you know, very philosophical, but as you have greater and greater freedom, again, go back 500 years ago, you didn't have a whole lot of freedom, right? You were born somewhere into a type of, like, family or place in life, and that's what you lived. Now there's, like, all this opportunity, and that is both beautiful, but it's also scary, right? And the authoritarian personality type says basically, you know, having those options is hard. And it's easier if someone basically, you know, provides structure, right? And I'd rather have someone providing structure than to have to deal with all of the ambiguity and stress of being responsible for myself. And I see all of that kind of playing out here, right? All of which is to say, like, again, all, there's this, you know, pendulum backswing that's starting to happen. I'm optimistic that, you know, it's about to start going back in the other direction, right? And that this sort of backlash to all of these freedoms maybe will help people realize that these freedoms are pretty damn good, right?
Right. Yeah. Yes. But it's really extraordinary as you think about kind of what you were saying there, is this idea of how dangerous or positive is change. And you're right, we're seeing a division, not just in the United States, but globally, about change. And there are groups who look to these traditional institutions, whether it's the church or, you know, ideology, the patriarchy, white Christian nationalism, all of that, and they look at change as threatening to their world order. Like, things no longer make sense. And you're right, that group craves order and authority. And so when somebody like Donald Trump comes along and says, the world is simple, I'm going to protect you, there's a tremendous appeal to that, because, you know, he is going to protect them. He also gives them something to fight for. And on the other side of this divide are those who want change, right? Who want to continue to push. They look at the changes of the last 25 or 30 years and say, yes, let's keep going.
Yeah.
And Zakaria talks about in the book, he talks about this shift that we used to think about the major divide in politics is between right and left, more government or less government. And he says the world is shifting in a way where that real divide is no longer left versus right. It's open versus closed. Hmm. You know, are you open to a new world, globalization, diversity, immigration, all of that? Or are you closed to that world? And do you want to have a more reactionary perspective where you go back to when times were simpler, vest, you know, power in these authority institutions of an individual or the church. And I really like that framework, saying that the real divide in the world right now is open versus closed mentality, because I just think it captures so much of what we're witnessing here.
Yep, I think it's great. And I think it's also important. I mean, we've talked a lot about, or at least I've had in my head as we've been talking, the United States. But this is like, he's making this argument about, you know, what's going on globally. And I think that's the part that's either reassuring or disconcerting, depending on how you look at it. But this is playing out basically in democracies across the world, right? Like the places it's not playing out, I guess, are, you know, in a place like China, where change is means something different. But you know, in Europe and democracies across the world, whether you're talking about France or Germany or you know, Italy or whatever, all these places Britain, where there's been this backlash, it's the same sort of concept, right? It's the same idea of we've achieved what we've wanted to achieve, and now what? And there's this kind of search for meaning, and one way you find meaning is by, you know, finding a battle again, right? Coming back around to, wanting order, trying to find some sort of conflict that gives you meaning. And oftentimes that conflict is against the world that has given you this opportunity. Yeah.
Well, it raises this important question. I know we got to move on, but like, how fast should change occur? And if you are one of those marginalized groups who doesn't have freedom, you want change fast, and you want it now. You'd like the what's happening. But on the other side, when the world changes so quickly, it only further alienates some of those groups. And Zakaria, in one of the chapters, kind of grapples with this question, and should we slow down, right, as a way of sort of reintegrating some of those who feel unmoored by all these changes? And it's a really interesting question, although I asked my students in my upper level global studies class, like, should we slow down? Should we, you know, stop the pace of all this change? And they're like, no, more change, faster, right? And I understand that. If you're one of those groups, the idea of slowing down is very, very dangerous. And why, right? Why should we placate individuals who've been in power, who've written the rules for years and years and years? It's time to revisit those. So much to break down there.
Well, and again, we need to move on. But I building off of what you said, I think about, like, I look to sort of generational change. And I think that's where you're going. Like, you're talking to young people. And I think, you know, a lot of this backlash, not all of it, but a lot of this backlash is coming from older generations or whatever. And so I feel like, you know, in the next 20 years, we're going to see pretty significant shifts. And that's where I think about this swing back in the positive direction. The other part that's sort of optimistic is that this kind of backlash is often normal, whether you're looking at democratic spreads around the world. This is, you know, waves of democratization. They often fall back. You look in the United States, post-civil rights movement, post-civil war, like, we make these strides forward. And then there are people who are made uncomfortable by that. And we have sort of this, like, recession a little bit before things sort of move forward. And so if I view it that way, then this, it doesn't mean I'm happy about this, but it maybe seems a little less scary if you understand the broader context of this sort of democratic backlash that's happening, not as like foreboding about the total collapse of democracy, but sort of as a natural backlash that will pass. That's more encouraging.
That's a really great point. And you know who it sounds like? My new rapper, Bulgarian friend, Big Chow. That's the sort of perspective about a global change that he embraced. So that's really thoughtful. All right, we should transition.
Yeah, so building off of the same notion, talking a little bit about liberalism. So, you know, Hal Brands had a fantastic piece in Foreign Affairs this month called The Age of Amorality. And in it, he begins with a 1946 quote from Reinhold Niebuhr, who you like, Bill. Niebuhr wrote at the end of World War II, this idea about, I thought I had it in here, but I don't, about, you know, how, do you have a quote before you, Bill?
I have the quote right here. Yeah.
Read it
to me. So Niebuhr says, how much evil must we do in order to do good? I think that is a very succinct statement on the human situation from Niebuhr, Reinhold Niebuhr. Yeah.
It's like this beautiful moral sort of dilemma, right? Like, this is a kind of an ends justify the means, or do they sort of question, like, how much evil do we do in order to do good? So Niebuhr wrote that at the end of World War II, in which the Allies had to carry out a variety, that's really kind of downplaying it, of morally problematic or repugnant acts in order to defeat the greater evil of Nazism. Brand argues that we're at a similar point in the world today. As the U.S. takes on the growing power of China and the aggressiveness of Russia, we find ourselves again asking just how much illiberalism will it take to save liberal democracy? And at what point do we go too far? Brands says that with when great powers... I messed up my typing again. When great powers go to war, they do so not just over land and glory. They fight over which ideas, which values will chart humanity's course. Ooh, so this is, you know, it's not just, it is, I mean, he's recognizing when, you know, US and China are battling things out, it is about power and territory and all that other stuff, but it's also about values. And Bill, I love and I hate these sorts of ethical dilemmas. They're wonderful and terrible at the same time. The article goes into some proposed rules to guide us as we deal with this, but I think maybe it's better for you and I just to jump in here. So is it hypocritical for the U.S. to take questionable approaches to defending good values? How do we do this? How do we think about this as we enter this new kind of Cold War, maybe, in the world?
I think it's a, like you said, it's a really important question. And if we think about Reinhold Niebuhr, or if we think about other, you know, sort of moral philosophers who've grappled with this, they make a sort of realist argument to say that, yes, the United States must engage, that we can't simply step back from the fight and say we don't want to get our hands dirty. That if you do that, there's a moral implication to that as well, right? And Niebuhr talks about we must take morally ambiguous actions, right? That we must act, knowing that we're probably going to screw up, but that doesn't mean we also don't reflect on this process, right? And so I think that's the moment we're at right now, thinking about the balance, defending the liberal order, defending democracy, human rights, the market, all of that are worthy things. And the United States should do so. And it may require them at times to do things that are not liberal. But you also have to be careful not to become the enemy who represents the threat to those, right? That it's the balance.
Yeah.
The article quotes Alexander Hamilton. I love this quote as well. And Hamilton talks about the means must be proportionate to the mischief. And I just love that idea, right? That we have to think about what are the, you know, what's that relationship between what we're doing and what we hope to achieve. I will say, during the Cold War, we didn't always get this balance right. Yeah. You know, you could think about U.S. support for dictatorships in Central America. You could think about, you know, the Vietnam War, thinking about the secret bombing of Cambodia. Those were all actions where we argued we were doing the moral thing by engaging in illiberal action. But with some hindsight, I think we look and say, no, those were just immoral actions that didn't push forward the cause of liberalism. And so it's really interesting. And in the world we currently inhabit, there's all sorts of dilemmas, and maybe we can get into that. But what's your read about how, I mean, should the United States be uncomfortable getting its hands dirty trying to defend liberalism?
I think that the way you phrased it just there is perfect, because I think the answer is yes, we should be uncomfortable about getting our hands dirty, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, right? And I think that's the important distinction. So I think there's a danger in like too much purity, like this idea of like we have to be perfect, and I feel like there's that element in, you know, appropriately, I think in American society, on kind of both sides, but like this, you know, expectation. I think about like this, you know, how do we approach Joe Biden if you have a problem with what's going on in Israel, and this expectation of like purity, of perfection, is probably not reasonable in the world of politics, because politics is complicated in these. And I think about legislation, right? So Joe Biden is, you know, he has a legislative background. And I think if you're trying to pass legislation, you're trying to achieve goals. And if you can find people who share similar goals, then you use them, even if they're problematic, right? And so, you know, if Marjorie Taylor Greene agrees with you on a piece of legislation, you want her vote. You don't say, I'm not going to work with you because you're problematic, right? And so that is like, that's one way. That's different from saying, I'm going to, you know, hold up Marjorie Taylor Greene as a perfect example of what we should be doing, right? So there is this in between between recognizing that what you're doing is, you know, not perfect, or the people you're working with are flawed, versus embracing those flaws, right? So there's, and that's where I think we often got it wrong in the Cold War. But I think about, like, as I was thinking about this before we started recording, I thought of, and this ties into what some of the stuff you were saying, I thought about Michael Walzer and his arguments about ethics in war. And he talks about specifically, so since we began with Niebuhr, he talks about during World War II, some of these actions that we took that were unethical, they were immoral, and there is a difference. So, you know, if you're bombing German cities, which is wrong, right? You're targeting civilians. Is that acceptable? And Walzer basically says, in order to defeat Nazism, it might have been required, but that's different from saying it's right. So when we talk about utilitarianism is this idea that, like, the ends justify the means, and so that would be saying, you know, if we have to prop up dictatorships in order to win the war for the global future, then propping up dictatorships is the right thing to do. Walzer's approach is different, which is to say, supporting liberalism is the right thing to do. If we have to do some bad things to do that, it might be worth it. But it does not make those bad things good. They're still good. Bad. We should still be ashamed of it. We should still feel bad about it. And I think that's an important thing, right? You don't want to suddenly convince yourself that the things you're doing are good just because the cause is good, right? And so it's a difficult line to walk, but I think it's an important line to sort of keep in mind.
This is a great point, right? There should be a reluctance to engaging in those actions, and the realization that what you're doing is morally hazardous, right? And I don't think that was always the case, as you note, during the Cold War, right? There was this sense that everything the United States does is justified. That, Kissinger's comment about, you know, Chile, that we're not going to let, you know, a democracy go communist because of its own voters, right? I mean, you know, sort of we should have been troubled by that. We should have said that, you know, but they genuinely believed they were always being the moral actor. And I think this is a slightly different balance that you're articulating. Brands talks about that. He says that morality is a compass, not a straitjacket. And I liked that as well, to say that morality should always be in the conversation. We should think about those things and have some perspective on it. But it shouldn't always constrain us. And I think about, I also, the other thing I was thinking about is our conversation a couple of years ago with Roland Paris. And we were talking about the rise of China. And he said one of the problems with the United States approach right now is they're unwilling to even accept China's rise, which isn't to say we shouldn't be critical of the things that they do that are wrong. But on some level, you have to accept that they are a legitimate power. And by doing that, it changes how you engage with China, right? China has a right to be powerful. They have a right to have a say in the international system. So you can't attack that. Like, attacking that would be immoral, right? They have a right to do that. You can also attack them for, you know, intellectual property rights. Like, those are the things, as we start to push into what that balance looks like, I think you have to accept certain things and then try to mitigate other actions, right? And so I like this idea of thinking about this question, but then pushing it forward a little bit. I love this debate.
That's brilliant. That is a really interesting, the Chinese example is a fascinating, and it's a perfect way of getting at these nuances, which is to say the rise of China is not immoral or problematic. It is the values that they espouse, right? And so what that means is their human rights record, you know, some of those elements, those are the problem. And that's what you have to be critical of. And it felt like during the Cold War, it was the idea that, you know, the other countries existing, right, was the other regimes existing was the problem. So rather than critiquing them on the values and having a debate around that, it became a debate about American dominance is the end point. And this is a good point as well, that you know, that maybe the focus is less on preventing Chinese rise and more on allowing China to occupy a role in the world, but never backing down on the critiques of human rights and other things that are problematic about the Chinese system, because that is, again, if this is really a debate about liberalism, that, you know, China is irrelevant to that. The values are the heart of it, right? Like, is China liberal or not? That's what we should be concerned about.
And it's on those issues that you could potentially get your hands dirty defending those principles.
Yep.
And China's not all of it. I mean, you think about India. The article talks about India as another really challenging case as it has its democratic backsliding. Does the United States continue to embrace India as a really important power to balance against China and others, even though it's a flawed democracy? And Brand seems to suggest that I think we have to do this, right? Yeah. You have to hope and do that. Saudi Arabia is another problematic dynamic. You know, Ukraine, how cluster bombs in Ukraine. Is it okay to use cluster bombs, which are unethical, to defeat Russia? Like, there's so many of these as you start to think about how do you move forward and defend that liberalism at an international level.
It is hard. I mean, it's all of those. There's a slippery slope to all of them, right? Like, you know, at some point you begin to rationalize an unethical or immoral actions. And I think you don't want to, I don't know. It doesn't mean that you should always avoid slippery slopes, but you should always be aware that you are on a slippery slope when you're on a slippery slope. Right. And so it is this notion of, you know, if using cluster bombs is, to use that example, right, it makes me uncomfortable to talk about that, and it should make us uncomfortable, but it should also be that if Russia is, you know, is able to win the war in Ukraine, there's a greater evil that come or a greater, you know, harm that comes from that. So it is, you know, if using cluster bombs is necessary, see, I'm uncomfortable even talking about it, but that should be how uncomfortable you are, right? And it should be that is as far as I'm willing to go. I recognize that I'm not willing to say anything is acceptable in supporting a Ukrainian victory, but yeah, it's difficult. It's, again, it's where, you know, you and I have talked about a lot. I love the fact that I get to sort of analyze and pick these apart and don't have to be the one making the decisions, because they're really difficult.
I am so impressed at how sharp you are this early in the morning. Right? That point about being aware when you're on a slippery slope, I wrote that down because that's gold. That's really good stuff.
Maybe it's not that I'm sharper. Maybe it's that you're barely awake enough to understand whether I'm making good points or not.
It's also possible. That's another explanation as well. We should probably wrap up on that moment. Why don't you remind everybody how they can stay connected and read a little bit about what we talked about today?
Yeah, so you can go to thepoliticslab.com and click on this week's episode, and we'll have that Brand's article about that we were just talking about Niebuhr, the stuff from Zakaria and his discussion of the backlash against liberalism. And I'll probably throw a couple of articles up about Trump's Bible sales as well. And so you can find all of that at thepoliticslab.com.
That is fantastic, Bill. All right, I will see you next week.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Phil.